But that was a lie, wasn't it? He knew the boy. They had shared each other, the way good friends can't, even after 40 years of it. He knew the boy, and the boy knew him, because they each had a kind of searchlight in their heads, something they hadn't asked for, something that had just been given. No, you got a flashlight. He the one with the searchlight. And sometimes that light, that shine, seemed like a pretty nice thing. You could pick the horses, or like the boy had said, you could tell your daddy where his trunk was when it turned up missing. But that was only dressing, the sauce on the salad. And down below there was as much bitter vetch in that salad as there was cool cucumber. You could taste pain and death and tears. And now the boy was stuck in that place. And he would go. For the boy. Because, speaking to the boy, they had only been different colors when they used their mouths. So he would go. He would do what he could, because if he didn't, the boy was going to die right inside his head. But because he was human, he could not help a bitter wish that the cup had never been passed his way. She had started to get out and come after him. He had been dumping a change of clothes into an overnight bag when the thought came to him, freezing him with the power of the memory as it always did when he thought of it. He tried to think of it as seldom as possible. The maid, Dolores Vickery, her name was, had been hysterical, had said some things to the other chambermaids, and worse still, to some of the guests. When the word got back to Ullman, as the silly quiff should have known it would do, he had fired her out of hand. She had come to Halloran in tears, not about being fired, but about the things she had seen in that second-floor room. She had gone into 217 to change the towels, she said, and there had been that Mrs. Massey, lying dead in the tub. That, of course, was impossible. Mrs. Massey had been discreetly taken away the day before, and was even then winging her way back to New York, in the shipping hold instead of the first class she'd been accustomed to. Halloran hadn't liked Dolores much, but he had gone up to look that evening. The maid was an olive-complected girl of 23, who waited table near the end of the season when things slowed down. She had a small shining, Halloran judged, really not more than a twinkle. A mousy-looking man and his escort, wearing a faded cloth coat, would come in for dinner, and Dolores would trade one of her tables for theirs. The mousy little man would leave a picture of Alexander Hamilton under his plate. Bad enough for the girl who had made the trade, but worse, Dolores would crow over it. She was lazy, a goof-off, in an operation run by a man who allowed no goof-offs. She would sit in a linen closet, reading a confession magazine and smoking. But whenever Ullman went on one of his unscheduled prowls, and woe to the girl he caught resting her feet, he found her working industriously, her magazine hidden under the sheets on a high shelf, her ashtray tucked safely into her uniform pocket. Yeah, Halloran thought, she'd been a goof-off and a sloven, and the other girls had resented her, but Dolores had had that little twinkle. It had always greased the skids for her. But what she had seen in 217 had scared her badly enough, so she was more than glad to pick up the walking papers Ullman had issued her and go. Why had she come to him? A shine knows a shine, Halloran thought, grinning at the pun. So he had gone up that night, and had let himself into the room which was to be reoccupied the next day. He had used the office pass key to get in, and if Ullman had caught him with that key, he would have joined Dolores Vickery on the unemployment line. The shower curtain around the tub had been drawn. He had pushed it back. But even before he did, he'd had a premonition of what he was going to see. Mrs. Massey, swollen and purple, lay soggily in the tub, which was half full of water. He had stood looking down at her, a pulse beating thickly in his throat. There had been other things at the Overlook. A bad dream that recurred at irregular intervals. Some sort of costume party, and he was catering it in the Overlook's ballroom, and at the shout to unmask, everybody exposed faces that were those of rotting insects. And there had been the hedge animals. Twice, maybe three times, he had or thought he had seen them move, ever so slightly. That dog would seem to change from his sitting-up posture to a slightly crouched one, and the lion seemed to move forward, as if menacing the little tykes on the playground. Last year in May, Ullman had sent him up to the attic to look for the ornate set of fire tools that now stood beside the lobby fireplace. While he had been up there, the three light bulbs strung overhead had gone out, and he had lost his way back to the trapdoor. He had stumbled around for an unknown length of time, closer and closer to panic, barking his shins on boxes and bumping into things, with a stronger and stronger feeling that something was stalking him in the dark. Some great and frightening creature that had just oozed out of the woodwork when the lights went out. And when he had literally stumbled over the trapdoor's ring bolt, he had hurried down as fast as he could, leaving the trap open, sooty and disheveled, with a feeling of disaster barely averted. Later, Ullman had come down to the kitchen personally, to inform him he had left the attic trapdoor open and the lights burning up there. Did Halloran think the guests wanted to go up there and play treasure hunt? Did he think electricity was free? And he suspected, no, was nearly positive, that several of the guests had seen or heard things, too. In the 3 years he had been there, the presidential suite had been booked 19 times. 6 of the guests who had put up there had left the hotel early, some of them looking markedly ill. Other guests had left other rooms with the same abruptness. One night in August of 1974, near dusk, a man who had won the bronze and silver stars in Korea, that man now sat on the boards of 3 major corporations and was said to have personally pink-slipped a famous TV news anchorman, unaccountably went into a fit of screaming hysterics on the putting green. And there had been dozens of children during Halloran's association with the Overlook who simply refused to go into the playground. One child had had a convulsion while playing in the concrete rings, but Halloran didn't know if that could be attributed to the Overlook's deadly siren song or not. Word had gone around among the help that the child, the only daughter of a handsome movie actor, was a medically controlled epileptic who had simply forgotten her medicine that day. And so, staring down at the corpse of Mrs. Massey, he had been frightened but not completely terrified. It was not completely unexpected. Terror came when she opened her eyes to disclose blank silver pupils and began to grin at him. Horror came when she had started to get out and come after him. He had fled, heart racing, and had not felt safe even with the door shut and locked behind him. In fact, he admitted to himself now as he zipped the flight bag shut, he had never felt safe anywhere in the Overlook again. And now the boy, calling, screaming for help. He looked at his watch. It was 5:30 p.m. He went to the apartment's door, remembered it would be heavy winter now in Colorado, especially up in the mountains, and went back to his closet. He pulled his long, sheepskin-lined overcoat out of its polyurethane dry-cleaning bag and put it over his arm. It was the only winter garment he owned. He turned off all the lights and looked around. Had he forgotten anything? Yes. One thing. He took the will out of his breast pocket and slipped it into the margin of the dressing table mirror. With luck, he would be back to get it. Sure, with luck. He left the apartment, locked the door behind him, put the key under the rush mat, and ran down the outside steps to his converted Cadillac. Halfway to Miami International, comfortably away from the switchboard where queems or queems toadies were known to listen in, Halloran stopped at a shopping center laundromat and called United Airlines. Flights to Denver? There was one due out at 6:36 p.m. Could the gentleman make that? Halloran looked at his watch, which showed 6:02, and said he could. What about vacancies on the flight? Just let me check. A clunking sound in his ear, followed by saccharine Montovani, which was supposed to make being on hold more pleasant. It didn't. Halloran danced from one foot to the other, alternating glances between his watch and a young girl with a sleeping baby in a hammock on her back, unloading a coin-op Maytag. She was afraid she was going to get home later than she planned, and the roast would burn, and her husband, Mark, Mike, Matt, would be mad. A minute passed. 2. He had just about made up his mind to drive ahead and take his chances when the canned-sounding voice of the flight reservations clerk came back on. There was an empty seat. A cancellation. It was in first class. Did that make any difference? No. He wanted it. Would that be cash or credit card? Cash, baby, cash. I've got to fly. And the name was? Halloran. 2 L's, 2 N's. Catch you later. He hung up and hurried toward the door. The girl's simple thought, worry for the roast, broadcast at him over and over until he thought he would go mad. Sometimes it was like that. For no reason at all, you would catch a thought, completely isolated, completely pure and clear, and usually completely useless. He almost made it. He had the limo cranked up to 80, and the airport was actually in sight when one of Florida's finest pulled him over. Halloran unrolled the electric window and opened his mouth at the cop who was flipping up pages in his citation book.
"I know," the cop said comfortingly. "It's a funeral in Cleveland. Your father. It's a wedding in Seattle. Your sister. A fire in San Jose that wiped out your Gramps candy store. Some really fine Cambodian red just waiting in a terminal locker in New York City. I love this piece of road just outside the airport. Even as a kid, story hour was my favorite part of school. Listen, officer, my son is—
The only part of the story I could never figure out until the end, the officer said, finding the right page in his citation book, is the driver's license number of the offending motorist storyteller and his registration information. So be a nice guy. Let me peek.
Halloran looked into the cop's calm blue eyes, debated telling his "my son is in critical condition" story anyway, and decided that would make things worse. This Smokey was no Queems. He dug out his wallet.
"Wonderful," the cop said. "Would you take them out for me, please? I just have to see how it's all going to come out in the end."
Silently, Halloran took out his driver's license and his Florida registration and gave them to the traffic cop.
"That's very good. That's so good, you win a present."
"What?" Halloran asked hopefully.
"When I finish writing down these numbers, I'm going to let you blow up a little balloon for me."
"Oh, Jesus," Halloran moaned. "Officer, my flight—"
"Shh,"
the traffic cop said.
"Don't be naughty."
Halloran closed his eyes. He got to the United desk at 6:49, hoping against hope that the flight had been delayed. He didn't even have to ask. The departure monitor over the incoming passenger's desk told the story. Flight 901 for Denver, due out at 6:36 EST, had left at 6:40, 9 minutes before.
"Oh, shit," Dick Halloran said.
And suddenly the smell of oranges, heavy and cloying. He had just time to reach the men's room before it came, deafening, terrified.
"Come! Please come! Dick! Please, please, come!"
39. On the Stairs. One of the things they had sold to swell their liquid assets a little before moving from Vermont to Colorado was Jack's collection of 200 old rock and roll and R&B albums. They had gone at the yard sale for $1 apiece. One of these albums, Danny's personal favorite, had been an Eddie Cochran double record set with 4 pages of bound-in liner notes by Lenny Kaye. Wendy had often been struck by Danny's fascination for this one particular album by a man-boy who had lived fast and died young, had died, in fact, when she herself had only been 10 years old. Now, at 7:15, Mountain Time, as Dick Halloran was telling Queems about his ex-wife's white boyfriend, she came upon Danny, sitting halfway up the stairs between the lobby and the first floor, tossing a red rubber ball from hand to hand and singing one of the songs from that album. His voice was low and tuneless. "So I climb 1, 2, flight 3, flight 4, Danny sang, 5 flight, 6 flight, 7 flight more. When I get to the top, I'm too tired to rock." She came around him, sat down on one of the stair risers, and saw that his lower lip had swelled to twice its size and that there was dried blood on his chin. Her heart took a frightened leap in her chest, but she managed to speak neutrally.
"What happened, Doc?"
she asked, although she was sure she knew. Jack had hit him. Well, of course. That came next, didn't it? The wheels of progress. Sooner or later they took you back to where you started from.
"I called Tony," Danny said, "in the ballroom. I guess I fell off the chair. It doesn't hurt anymore, just feels like my lip's too big."
"Is that what really happened?" she asked, looking at him, troubled.
"Daddy didn't do it," he answered. "Not today."
She gazed at him, feeling eerie. The ball traveled from one hand to the other. He had read her mind. Her son had read her mind.
What did Tony tell you, Danny? It doesn't matter."
His face was calm.
his voice chillingly indifferent. Danny? She gripped his shoulder, harder than she had intended. But he didn't wince or even try to shake her off. Oh, we are wrecking this boy. It's not just Jack. It's me, too. And maybe it's not even just us. Jack's father, my mother, are they here, too? Sure, why not? The place is lousy with ghosts anyway. Why not a couple more? Oh, Lord in heaven, he's like one of those suitcases they show on TV. Run over, dropped from planes, going through factory crushers. Or a Timex watch, takes a licking and keeps on ticking. Oh, Danny, I'm so sorry. It doesn't matter, he said again. The ball went from hand to hand. Tony can't come anymore. They won't let him. He's licked. Who won't? The people in the hotel, he said. He looked at her then, and his eyes weren't indifferent at all. They were deep and scared. And the things in the hotel. There's all kinds of them. The hotel is stuffed with them. You can see? I don't want to see, he said low, and then looked back at the rubber ball, arcing from hand to hand. But I can hear them sometimes, late at night. They're like the wind, all sighing together, in the attic, the basement, the rooms, all over. I thought it was my fault, because of the way I am. The key. The little silver key. Danny, don't. Don't upset yourself this way. But it's him, too, Danny said. It's Daddy. And it's you. It wants all of us. It's tricking Daddy. It's fooling him, trying to make him think it wants him the most. It wants me the most, but it will take all of us. If only that snowmobile. They wouldn't let him, Danny said in that same low voice. They made him throw part of it away into the snow. Far away. I dreamed it. And he knows that woman really is in 217. He looked at her with his dark, frightened eyes. It doesn't matter whether you believe me or not. She slipped an arm around him. I believe you, Danny. Tell me the truth. Is he going to try to hurt us? They'll try to make him, Danny said. I've been calling for Mr. Halloran. He said if I ever needed him to just call, and I have been. But it's awful hard. It makes me tired. And the worst part is I don't know if he's hearing me or not. I don't think he can call back because it's too far for him, and I don't know if it's too far for me or not. Tomorrow.
What about tomorrow?
He shook his head. Nothing.
Where is he now? She asked. Your daddy.
He's in the basement. I don't think he'll be up tonight.
She stood up suddenly. Wait right here for me. 5 minutes.
The kitchen was cold and deserted under the overhead fluorescent bars. She went to the rack where the carving knives hung from their magnetized strips. She took the longest and sharpest, wrapped it in a dish towel, and left the kitchen, turning off the lights as she went. Danny sat on the stairs, his eyes following the course of his red rubber ball from hand to hand. He sang,
She lives on the 20th floor uptown. The elevator is broken down. So I walk 1, 2 flight, 3 flight 4. Loo, loo, skip to Maloo.
His singing broke off. He listened.
Skip to Maloo, my darling.
The voice was in his head, so much a part of him, so frighteningly close, that it might have been a part of his own thoughts. It was soft and infinitely sly, mocking him, seeming to say,
Oh, yes, you'll like it here. Try it. You'll like it. Try it. You'll like it.
Now his ears were open, and he could hear them again, the gathering, ghosts or spirits, or maybe the hotel itself. A dreadful funhouse where all the sideshows ended in death, where all the specially painted boogies were really alive, where hedges walked, where a small silver key could start the obscenity. Soft and sighing, rustling like the endless winter wind that played under the eaves at night, the deadly lulling wind the summer tourists never heard. It was like the somnolent hum of summer wasps in a ground nest, sleepy, deadly, beginning to wake up. They were 10,000 feet high. Why is a raven like a writing desk? The higher, the fewer, of course. Have another cup of tea. It was a living sound, but not voices, not breath. A man of a philosophical bent might have called it the sound of souls. Dick Halloran's Nana, who had grown up on southern roads in the years before the turn of the century, would have called it haunts. A psychic investigator might have had a long name for it. Psychic echo, psychokinesis, a telesmic sport. But to Danny, it was only the sound of the hotel, the old monster, creaking steadily and ever more closely around them, halls that now stretched back through time as well as distance, hungry shadows, unquiet guests who did not rest easy. In the darkened ballroom, the clock under glass struck 7:30 with a single musical note. A hoarse voice, made brutal with drink, shouted, "Unmask! And let's fuck!" Wendy, halfway across the lobby, jerked to a standstill. She looked at Danny on the stairs, still tossing the ball from hand to hand. "Did you hear something?" Danny only looked at her and continued to toss the ball from hand to hand. There would be little sleep for them that night, although they slept together behind a locked door. And in the dark, his eyes open, Danny thought, "He wants to be one of them and live forever. That's what he wants." Wendy thought, "If I have to, I'll take him further up. If we're going to die, I'd rather do it in the mountains." She had left the butcher knife, still wrapped in the towel, under the bed. She kept her hand close to it. They dozed off and on. The hotel creaked around them. Outside, snow had begun to spit down from a sky like lead.
40. In the basement. The boiler. The goddamn boiler. The thought came into Jack Torrance's mind full-blown, edged in bright, warning red. On its heels, the voice of Watson, "If you forget, it'll just creep and creep, and like as not, you and your family will end up on the fucking moon. She's rated for 250, but she'd blow long before that now. I'd be scared to come down and stand next to her at 180. He'd been down here all night, poring over the boxes of old records, possessed by a frantic feeling that time was getting short, and he would have to hurry. Still, the vital clues, the connections that would make everything clear, eluded him. His fingers were yellow and grimy with crumbling old paper, and he'd become so absorbed he hadn't checked the boiler once. He'd dumped it the previous evening around 6 o'clock, when he first came down. It was now. He looked at his watch and jumped up, kicking over a stack of old invoices. Christ, it was 4:15 in the morning. Behind him, the furnace kicked on. The boiler was making a groaning, whistling sound. He ran to it. His face, which had become thinner in the last month or so, was now heavily shadowed with beard stubble, and he had a hollow, concentration camp look. The boiler pressure gauge stood at 210 pounds per square inch. He fancied he could almost see the sides of the old, patched and welded boiler heaving out with the lethal strain. "She creeps. I'd be scared to come down and stand next to her at 180. Suddenly a cold and tempting inner voice spoke to him. "Let it go. Go get Wendy and Danny and get the fuck out of here. Let it blow sky high." He could visualize the explosion, a double thunderclap that would first rip the heart from this place, then the soul. The boiler would go with an orange-violet flash that would rain hot and burning shrapnel all over the cellar. In his mind, he could see the red-hot trinkets of metal careening from floor to walls to ceiling like strange billiard balls, whistling jagged death through the air. Some of them surely would whiz right through that stone arch, light on the old papers on the other side, and they would burn merry hell. Destroy the secrets, burn the clues. It's a mystery no living hand will ever solve. Then the gas explosion, a great rumbling crackle of flame, a giant pilot light that would turn the whole center of the hotel into a broiler. Stairs and hallways and ceilings and rooms aflame like the castle in the last reel of a Frankenstein movie. The flame spreading into the wings, hurrying up the black and blue twined carpets like eager guests. The silk wallpaper charring and curling. There were no sprinklers, only those outmoded hoses and no one to use them. And there wasn't a fire engine in the world that could get here before late March. Burn, baby, burn. In 12 hours, there would be nothing left but the bare bones. The needle on the gauge had moved up to 212. The boiler was creaking and groaning, like an old woman trying to get out of bed. Hissing jets of steam had begun to play around the edges of old patches. Beads of solder had begun to sizzle. He didn't see. He didn't hear. Frozen with his hand on the valve that would dump off the pressure and damp the fire, Jack's eyes glittered from their sockets like sapphires. It's my last chance. The only thing not cashed in now was the life insurance policy he had taken out jointly with Wendy in the summer between his first and second years at Stovington. $40,000 death benefit, double indemnity if he or she died in a train crash, a plane crash, or a fire. 7-11, die the secret death and win $100. A fire, $80,000. They would have time to get out. Even if they were sleeping, they would have time to get out. He believed that. And he didn't think the hedges or anything else would try to hold them back if the overlook was going up in flames. Flames. The needle inside the greasy, almost opaque dial had danced up to 215 pounds per square inch. Another memory occurred to him, a childhood memory. There had been a wasp's nest in the lower branches of their apple tree behind the house. One of his older brothers, he couldn't remember which one now, had been stung while swinging in the old tire Daddy had hung from one of the tree's lower branches. It had been late summer, when wasps tend to be at their ugliest. Their father, just home from work, dressed in his whites, the smell of beer hanging around his face in a fine mist, had gathered all three boys, Brett, Mike, and little Jackie, and told them he was going to get rid of the wasps. "Now watch," he had said, smiling and staggering a little. He hadn't been using the cane then. The collision with the milk truck was years in the future. "Maybe you'll learn something. My father showed me this." He had raked a big pile of rain-dampened leaves under the branch where the wasp's nest rested, a deadlier fruit than the shrunken but tasty apples their tree usually produced in late September, which was then still half a month away. He lit the leaves. The day was clear and windless. The leaves smoldered but didn't really burn, and they made a smell, a fragrance, that had echoed back to him each fall when men in Saturday pants and light windbreakers raked leaves together and burned them. A sweet smell, with a bitter undertone, rich and evocative. The smoldering leaves produced great rafts of smoke that drifted up to obscure the nest. Their father had let the leaves smolder all that afternoon, drinking beer on the porch and dropping the empty black label cans into his wife's plastic floor bucket, while his two older sons flanked him and little Jackie sat on the steps at his feet, playing with his bolo bouncer and singing monotonously over and over, "Your cheating heart will make you weep. Your cheating heart is gonna tell on you." At 6:15, just before supper, Daddy had gone out to the apple tree with his sons grouped carefully behind him. In one hand, he had a garden hoe. He knocked the leaves apart, leaving little clots spread around to smolder and die. Then he reached the hoe handle up, weaving and blinking, and after 2 or 3 tries, he knocked the nest to the ground. The boys fled for the safety of the porch, but Daddy only stood over the nest, swaying and blinking down at it. Jackie crept back to see. A few wasps were crawling sluggishly over the paper terrain of their property, but they were not trying to fly. From the inside of the nest, the black and alien place, came a never-to-be-forgotten sound, a low, somnolent buzz, like the sound of high-tension wires.
"Why don't they try to sting you, Daddy?" he had asked.
"The smoke makes him drunk, Jackie. Go get my gas can."
He ran to fetch it. Daddy doused the nest with amber gasoline.
"Now step away, Jackie, unless you want to lose your eyebrows."
He had stepped away. From somewhere in the voluminous folds of his white overblouse, Daddy had produced a wooden kitchen match. He lit it with his thumbnail and flung it onto the nest. There had been a white-orange explosion almost soundless in its ferocity. Daddy had stepped away, cackling wildly. The wasp's nest had gone up in no time.
"Fire," Daddy had said, turning to Jackie with a smile. "Fire will kill anything."
After supper, the boys had come out in the day's waning light to stand solemnly around the charred and blackened nest. From the hot interior had come the sound of wasp bodies, popping like corn. The pressure gauge stood at 220. A low iron wailing sound was building up in the guts of the thing. Jets of steam stood out erect in 100 places like porcupine quills.
Fire will kill anything.
Jack suddenly started. He had been dozing off, and he had almost dozed himself right into Kingdom Come. What in God's name had he been thinking of? Protecting the hotel was his job. He was the caretaker. A sweat of terror sprang to his hands so quickly that at first he missed his grip on the large valve. Then he curled his fingers around its spokes. He whirled it one turn, two, three. There was a giant hiss of steam, dragon's breath. A warm tropical mist rose from beneath the boiler and veiled him. For a moment he could no longer see the dial, but thought he must have waited too long. The groaning, clanking sound inside the boiler increased, followed by a series of heavy rattling sounds and the wrenching screech of metal. When some of the steam blew away, he saw that the pressure gauge had dropped back to 200 and was still sinking. The jets of steam escaping around the soldered patches began to lose their force. The wrenching, grinding sounds began to diminish. 190, 180, 175. He was going downhill, going 90 miles an hour when the whistle broke into a scream. But he didn't think it would blow now. The press was down to 160. They found him in the wreck with his hand on the throttle. He was scalded to death by the steam. He stepped away from the boiler, breathing hard, trembling. He looked at his hands and saw that blisters were already rising on his palms. Hell with the blisters, he thought, and laughed shakily. He had almost died with his hand on the throttle, like Casey the engineer in The Wreck of the Old 97. Worse still, he would have killed the Overlook. The final crashing failure. He had failed as a teacher, a writer, a husband, and a father. He had even failed as a drunk. But you couldn't do much better in the old failure category than to blow up the building you were supposed to be taking care of. And this was no ordinary building, by no means. Christ, but he needed a drink. The press had dropped down to 80 PSI. Cautiously, wincing a little at the pain in his hands, he closed the dump valve again. But from now on, the boiler would have to be watched more closely than ever. It might have been seriously weakened. He wouldn't trust it at more than 100 PSI for the rest of the winter. And if they were a little chilly, they would just have to grin and bear it. He had broken two of the blisters. His hands throbbed like rotten teeth. A drink. A drink would fix him up, and there wasn't a thing in the goddamn house besides cooking sherry. At this point, a drink would be medicinal. That was just it, by God. An anesthetic. He had done his duty, and now he could use a little anesthetic. Something stronger than Excedrin. But there was nothing. He remembered bottles glittering in the shadows. He had saved the hotel. The hotel would want to reward him. He felt sure of it. He took his handkerchief out of his back pocket and went to the stairs. He rubbed at his mouth. Just a little drink. Just one. To ease the pain. He had served the Overlook, and now the Overlook would serve him. He was sure of it. His feet on the stair risers were quick and eager, the hurrying steps of a man who has come home from a long and bitter war. It was 5:20 a.m., MST. 41. Daylight. Danny awoke with a muffled gasp from a terrible dream. There had been an explosion, a fire. The Overlook was burning up. He and his mommy were watching it from the front lawn. Mommy had said, "Look, Danny, look at the hedges." He looked at them and they were all dead. Their leaves had turned a suffocant brown. The tightly packed branches showed through like the skeletons of half-dismembered corpses. And then his daddy had burst out of the Overlook's big double doors, and he was burning like a torch. His clothes were in flames, his skin had acquired a dark and sinister tan that was growing darker by the moment, his hair was a burning bush. That was when he woke up, his throat tight with fear, his hands clutching at the sheet and blankets. Had he screamed? He looked over at his mother. Wendy lay on her side, the blankets up to her chin, a sheaf of straw-colored hair lying against her cheek. She looked like a child herself. No, he hadn't screamed. Lying in bed, looking upward, the nightmare began to drain away. He had a curious feeling that some great tragedy, fire, explosion, had been averted by inches. He let his mind drift out, searching for his daddy, and found him standing somewhere below, in the lobby.
Danny pushed a little harder, trying to get inside his father. It was not good, because Daddy was thinking about the bad thing. He was thinking how
good just one or two would be, I don't care. Sun's over the yardarm somewhere in the world. Remember how we used to say that, Al? Gin and tonic, bourbon with just a dash of bitters, scotch and soda, rum and coke, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, a drink for me and a drink for thee. The Martians have landed somewhere in the world. Princeton or Houston or Stokely-on-Carmichael, some fucking place. After all, 'tis the season, and none of us are—
Get out of his mind, you little shit!
He recoiled in terror from that mental voice, his eyes widening, his hands tightening into claws on the counterpane. It hadn't been the voice of his father, but a clever mimic, a voice he knew. Hoarse, brutal, yet underpointed with a vacuous sort of humor. Was it so near, then? He threw the covers back and swung his feet out onto the floor. He kicked his slippers out from under the bed and put them on. He went to the door and pulled it open and hurried up to the main corridor, his slippered feet whispering on the nap of the carpet runner. He turned the corner. There was a man on all fours halfway down the corridor, between him and the stairs. Danny froze. The man looked up at him. His eyes were tiny and red. He was dressed in some sort of silvery, spangled costume. A dog costume, Danny realized. Protruding from the rump of this strange creation was a long and floppy tail with a puff on the end. A zipper ran up the back of the costume to the neck. To the left of him was a dog's or wolf's head, blank eye sockets above the muzzle, the mouth open in a meaningless snarl that showed the rug's black and blue pattern between fangs that appeared to be papier-mâché. The man's mouth and chin and cheeks were smeared with blood. He began to growl at Danny. He was grinning, but the growl was real. It was deep in his throat, a chilling, primitive sound. Then he began to bark. His teeth were also stained red. He began to crawl toward Danny, dragging his boneless tail behind him. The costume dog's head lay unheeded on the carpet, glaring vacantly over Danny's shoulder.
"Let me by," Danny said.
"I'm going to eat you, little boy,"
the dogman answered. And suddenly a fusillade of barks came from his grinning mouth. They were human imitations, but the savagery in them was real. The man's hair was dark, greased with sweat from his confining costume. There was a mixture of scotch and champagne on his breath. Danny flinched back, but didn't run.
"Let me by."
"Not by the hair of my chinny-chin-chin,"
the dogman replied. His small red eyes were fixed attentively on Danny's face. He continued to grin.
"I'm going to eat you up, little boy, and I think I'll start with your plump little cock."
He began to prance skittishly forward, making little leaps and snarling. Danny's nerve broke. He fled back into the short hallway that led to their quarters, looking back over his shoulder. There was a series of mixed howls and barks and growls, broken by slurred mutterings and giggles. Danny stood in the hallway trembling.
"Get it up!"
the drunken dogman cried out from around the corner. His voice was both violent and despairing.
"Get it up, Harry, you bitch bastard! I don't care how many casinos and airlines and movie companies you own, I know what you like in the privacy of your own home. Get it up! I'll huff and I'll puff until Harry Derwent's all blown down."
He ended with a long, chilling howl that seemed to turn into a scream of rage and pain just before it dwindled off. Danny turned apprehensively to the closed bedroom door at the end of the hallway and walked quietly down to it. He opened it and poked his head through. His mommy was sleeping in exactly the same position. No one was hearing this but him. He closed the door softly and went back up to the intersection of their corridor and the main hall, hoping the dogman would be gone, the way the blood on the walls of the presidential suite had been gone. He peeked around the corner carefully. The man in the dog costume was still there. He had put his head back on and was now prancing on all fours by the stairwell, chasing his tail. He occasionally leaped off the rug and came down, making dog grunts in his throat.
"Woof! Woof! Bow!"
These sounds came hollowly out of the mask's stylized, snarling mouth, and among them were sounds that might have been sobs or laughter. Danny went back to the bedroom and sat down on his cot, covering his eyes with his hands. The hotel was running things now. Maybe at first the things that had happened had only been accidents. Maybe at first the things he had seen really were like scary pictures that couldn't hurt him. But now the hotel was controlling those things, and they could hurt. The Overlook hadn't wanted him to go to his father. That might spoil all the fun. So it had put the dog man in his way, just as it had put the hedge animals between them and the road. But his daddy could come here, and sooner or later his daddy would. He began to cry, the tears rolling silently down his cheeks. It was too late. They were going to die, all three of them, and when the Overlook opened next late spring, they would be right here to greet the guests along with the rest of the spooks. The woman in the tub, the dog man, the horrible dark thing that had been in the cement tunnel. They would be,
"Stop! Stop that now!"
He knuckled the tears furiously from his eyes. He would try as hard as he could to keep that from happening. Not to himself, not to his daddy and mommy. He would try as hard as he could. He closed his eyes and sent his mind out in a high, hard, crystal bolt.
"Dick, please, come quick. We're in bad trouble. Dick, we need—"
And suddenly, in the darkness behind his eyes, the thing that chased him down the Overlook's dark halls in his dreams was there, right there, a huge creature dressed in white, its prehistoric club raised over its head.
"I'll make you stop it, you goddamn puppy! I'll make you stop it because I am your father!"
"No!"
He jerked back to the reality of the bedroom, his eyes wide and staring, the screams tumbling helplessly from his mouth as his mother bolted awake, clutching the sheet to her breasts.
"No, Daddy! No, no, no!"
And they both heard the vicious, descending swing of the invisible club, cutting the air somewhere very close, then fading away to silence as he ran to his mother and hugged her, trembling like a rabbit in a snare. The Overlook was not going to let him call Dick. That might spoil the fun, too. They were alone. Outside, the snow came harder, curtaining them off from the world. 42. Mid-air. Dick Halloran's flight was called at 6:45 a.m., EST, and the boarding clerk held him by gate 31, shifting his flight bag nervously from hand to hand until the last call at 6:55. They were both looking for a man named Carlton Vecker, the only passenger on TWA's flight 196 from Miami to Denver who hadn't checked in. "Okay," the clerk said, and issued Halloran a blue first-class boarding pass. "You lucked out. You can board, sir." Halloran hurried up the enclosed boarding ramp and let the mechanically grinning stewardess tear his pass off and give him the stub.
"We're serving breakfast on the flight," the stew said.
"If you'd like—"
"Just coffee, babe," he said, and went down the aisle to a seat in the smoking section.
He kept expecting the no-show Vecker to pop through the door like a jack-in-the-box at the last second. The woman in the seat by the window was reading, "You can be your own best friend," with a sour, unbelieving expression on her face. Halloran buckled his seatbelt and then wrapped his large black hands around the seat's armrests and promised the absent Carlton Vecker that it would take him and five strong TWA flight attendants to drag him out of his seat. He kept his eye on his watch. It dragged off the minutes to the 7 o'clock takeoff time with maddening slowness. At 7:05, the stewardess informed them that there would be a slight delay while the ground crew rechecked one of the latches on the cargo door.
"Shit for brains," Dick Halloran muttered.
The sharp-faced woman turned her sour, unbelieving expression on him, and then went back to her book. He had spent the night at the airport, going from counter to counter, United, American, TWA, Continental, Braniff, haunting the ticket clerks. Sometime after midnight, drinking his eighth or ninth cup of coffee in the canteen, he had decided he was being an asshole to have taken this whole thing on his own shoulders. There were authorities. He had gone down to the nearest bank of telephones, and after talking to three different operators, he had gotten the emergency number of the Rocky Mountain National Park Authority. The man who answered the telephone sounded utterly worn out.
Halloran had given a false name and said there was trouble at the Overlook Hotel, west of Sidewinder. Bad trouble. He was put on hold. The ranger, Halloran assumed he was a ranger, came back on in about 5 minutes. "They've got a CB," the ranger said.
"Sure they've got a CB," Halloran said.
"We haven't had a Mayday call from them."
"Man, that don't matter. They..."
"Exactly what kind of trouble are they in, Mr. Hall?"
"Well, there's a family. The caretaker and his family. I think maybe he's gone a little nuts, you know? I think maybe he might hurt his wife and his little boy."
"May I ask how you've come by this information, sir?" Halloran closed his eyes.
"What's your name, fellow?"
"Tom Staunton, sir."
"Well, Tom, I know. Now I'll be just as straight with you as I can be. There's bad trouble up there. Maybe killing bad. Do you dig what I'm saying?"
"Mr. Hall, I really have to know how you..."
"Look," Halloran had said, "I'm telling you, I know. A few years back there was a fellow up there named O'Grady. He killed his wife and his two daughters and then pulled the string on himself. I'm telling you it's going to happen again if you guys don't haul your asses out there and stop it."
"Mr. Hall, you're not calling from Colorado."
"No. But what difference..."
"If you're not in Colorado, you're not in CB range of the Overlook Hotel. If you're not in CB range, you can't possibly have been in contact with the, faint rattle of papers, the Torrance family. While I had you on hold, I tried to telephone. It's out, which is nothing unusual. There are still 25 miles of above-ground telephone lines between the hotel and the Sidewinder switching station. My conclusion is that you must be some sort of crank."
"Oh, man, you stupid..."
But his despair was too great to find a noun to go with the adjective. Suddenly, illumination.
"Call them," he cried.
"Sir?"
"You got the CB, they got the CB, so call them. Call them and ask them what's up."
There was a brief silence and the humming of long-distance wires.
"You tried that too, didn't you?" Halloran asked. "That's why you had me on hold so long. You tried the phone, and then you tried the CB, and you didn't get nothing. But you don't think nothing's wrong. What are you guys doing up there? Sitting on your asses and playing gin rummy?"
"No, we are not," Staunton said angrily. Halloran was relieved at the sound of anger in the voice. For the first time, he felt he was speaking to a man, and not to a recording.
"I'm the only man here, sir.
Every other ranger in the park, plus game wardens, plus volunteers, are up in Hasty Notch, risking their lives because three stupid assholes with 6 months' experience decided to try the north face of King's Ram. They're stuck halfway up there, and maybe they'll get down and maybe they won't. There are two choppers up there, and the men who are flying them are risking their lives because it's night here and it's starting to snow. So if you're still having trouble putting it all together, I'll give you a hand with it. Number one, I don't have anybody to send to the Overlook. Number two, the Overlook isn't a priority here. What happens in the park is a priority. Number three, by daybreak, neither one of those choppers will be able to fly because it's going to snow like crazy, according to the National Weather Service. Do you understand the situation?"
"Yeah," Halloran had said softly. "I understand."
"Now my guess as to why I couldn't raise them on the CB is very simple. I don't know what time it is where you are, but out here it's 9:30. I think they may have turned it off and gone to bed. Now if you..."
"Good luck with your climbers, man," Halloran said. "But I want you to know that they are not the only ones who are stuck up high because they didn't know what they were getting into."
He had hung up the phone. At 7:20 a.m., the TWA 747 backed lumberingly out of its stall, turned, and rolled out toward the runway. Halloran let out a long, soundless exhale. "Carlton Vecker, wherever you are, eat your heart out." Flight 196 parted company with the ground at 7:28, and at 7:31, as it gained altitude, the thought pistol went off in Dick Halloran's head again. His shoulders hunched uselessly against the smell of oranges, and then jerked spasmodically. His forehead wrinkled, his mouth drew down in a grimace of pain.
"Dick, please, come quick. We're in bad trouble. Dick, we need..."
And that was all. It was suddenly gone. No fading out this time. The communication had been chopped off cleanly, as if with a knife. It scared him. His hands, still clutching the seat rests, had gone almost white. His mouth was dry. Something had happened to the boy, he was sure of it. If anyone had hurt that little child.
"Do you always react so violently to takeoffs?"
He looked around.
It was the woman in the horn-rimmed glasses.
It wasn't that, Halloran said. I've got a steel plate in my head. From Korea. Every now and then gives me a twinge. Vibrates, don't you know. Scrambles the signal.
Is that so?
Yes, ma'am.
It is the lion soldier who ultimately pays for any foreign intervention, the sharp-faced woman said grimly.
Is that so?
It is. This country must swear off its dirty little wars. The CIA has been at the root of every dirty little war America has fought in this century. The CIA and dollar diplomacy.
She opened her book and began to read. The no-smoking sign went off. Halloran watched the receding land and wondered if the boy was all right. He had developed an affectionate feeling for that boy, although his folks hadn't seemed all that much. He hoped to God they were watching out for Danny.
43. Drinks on the House. Jack stood in the dining room, just outside the batwing doors leading into the Colorado Lounge, his head cocked, listening. He was smiling faintly. Around him, he could hear the Overlook Hotel coming to life. It was hard to say just how he knew, but he guessed it wasn't greatly different from the perceptions Danny had from time to time, like father, like son. Wasn't that how it was popularly expressed? It wasn't a perception of sight or sound, although it was very near to those things, separated from those senses by the filmiest of perceptual curtains. It was as if another overlook now lay scant inches beyond this one, separated from the real world, if there is such a thing as a real world, Jack thought, but gradually coming into balance with it. He was reminded of the 3D movies he'd seen as a kid. If you looked at the screen without the special glasses, you saw a double image, the sort of thing he was feeling now. But when you put the glasses on, it made sense. All the hotel's eras were together now, all but this current one, the Torrance era. And this would be together with the rest very soon now. That was good. That was very good. He could almost hear the self-important ding-ding of the silver-plated bell on the registration desk, summoning bellboys to the front as men in the fashionable flannels of the 1920s checked in and men in fashionable 1940s double-breasted pinstripes checked out. There would be three nuns sitting in front of the fireplace as they waited for the checkout line to thin, and standing behind them, nattily dressed with diamond stick pins holding their blue and white figured ties, Charles Grandin and Vito Gianelli discussed profit and loss, life and death. There were a dozen trucks in the loading bays out back, some laid one over the other like bad time exposures. In the East Wing ballroom, a dozen different business conventions were going on at the same time within temporal centimeters of each other. There was a costume ball going on. There were soirees, wedding receptions, birthday and anniversary parties. Men talking about Neville Chamberlain and the Archduke of Austria. Music, laughter, drunkenness, hysteria. Little love, not here, but a steady undercurrent of sensuousness. And he could almost hear all of them together, drifting through the hotel and making a graceful cacophony. In the dining room where he stood, breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 70 years were all being served simultaneously just behind him. He could almost, no, strike the almost, he could hear them, faintly as yet, but clearly, the way one can hear thunder miles off on a hot summer's day. He could hear all of them, the beautiful strangers. He was becoming aware of them as they must have been aware of him from the very start. All the rooms of the Overlook were occupied this morning. A full house. And beyond the bat wings, a low murmur of conversation drifted and swirled like lazy cigarette smoke. More sophisticated, more private. Low, throaty female laughter, the kind that seems to vibrate in a fairy ring around the viscera and the genitals. The sound of a cash register, its window softly lighted in the warm half-dark, ringing up the price of a gin Ricky, a Manhattan, a depression bomber, a slow gin fizz, a zombie. The jukebox pouring out its drinker's melodies, each one overlapping the other in time. He pushed the batwings open and stepped through.
Hello, boys, Jack Torrance said softly. I've been away, but now I'm back.
Good evening, Mr. Torrance, Lloyd said, genuinely pleased. It's good to see you.
It's good to be back, Lloyd, he said gravely, and hooked his leg over a stool between a man in a sharp blue suit and a bleary-eyed woman in a black dress who was peering into the depths of a Singapore sling.
What will it be, Mr. Torrance?
Martini, he said, with great pleasure.
He looked at the back bar with its rows of dimly gleaming bottles capped with their silver siphons.
Jim Beam, Wild Turkey, Gilby's, Sherrod's Private Label, Toro, Seagram's, and home again.
One large Martian, if you please, he said. They've landed somewhere in the world, Lloyd.
He took his wallet out and laid a 20 carefully on the bar.
As Lloyd made his drink, Jack looked over his shoulder. Every booth was occupied. Some of the occupants were dressed in costumes, a woman in gauzy harem pants and a rhinestone-sparkled brassiere, a man with a fox head rising slyly out of his evening dress, a man in a silvery dog outfit who was tickling the nose of a woman in a sarong with the puff on the end of his long tail, to the general amusement of all.
No charge to you, Mr. Torrance, Lloyd said, putting the drink down on Jack's 20. Your money is no good here. Orders from the manager.
Manager?
A faint unease came over him. Nevertheless, he picked up the martini glass and swirled it, watching the olive at the bottom bob slightly in the drink's chilly depths.
Of course. The manager.
Lloyd's smile broadened, but his eyes were socketed in shadow, and his skin was horribly white, like the skin of a corpse.
Later, he expects to see to your son's well-being himself. He is very interested in your son. Danny is a talented boy.
The juniper fumes of the gin were pleasantly maddening, but they also seemed to be blurring his reason.
Danny. What was all of this about Danny? And what was he doing in a bar with a drink in his hand?
He had taken the pledge. He had gone on the wagon. He had sworn off.
What could they want with his son?
What could they want with Danny?
Wendy and Danny weren't in it.
He tried to see into Lloyd's shadowed eyes, but it was too dark. Too dark. It was like trying to read emotion into the empty orbs of a skull.
It's me they must want, isn't it? I am the one. Not Danny, not Wendy. I'm the one who loves it here. They wanted to leave. I'm the one who took care of the snowmobile, went through the old records, dumped the press on the boiler, lied, practically sold my soul. What can they want with him?
Where is the manager? He tried to ask it casually, but his words seemed to come out between lips already numbed by the first drink, like words from a nightmare rather than those in a sweet dream.
Lloyd only smiled. What do you want with my son? Danny's not in this, is he?
He heard the naked plea in his own voice. Lloyd's face seemed to be running, changing, becoming something pestilent. The white skin becoming a hepatitic yellow, cracking. Red sores erupting on the skin, bleeding foul-smelling liquid. Droplets of blood sprang out on Lloyd's forehead like sweat, and somewhere a silver chime was striking the quarter hour.
Unmask! Unmask!
Drink your drink, Mr. Torrance, Lloyd said softly. It isn't a matter that concerns you. Not at this point.
He picked his drink up again, raised it to his lips, and hesitated.
He heard the hard, horrible snap as Danny's arm broke. He saw the bicycle flying brokenly up over the hood of Al's car, starring the windshield. He saw a single wheel lying in the road, twisted spokes pointing into the sky like jags of piano wire. He became aware that all conversation had stopped. He looked back over his shoulder. They were all looking at him expectantly, silently. The man beside the woman in the sarong had removed his fox head, and Jack saw that it was Horace Derwent, his pallid blonde hair spilling across his forehead. Everyone at the bar was watching, too. The woman beside him was looking at him closely, as if trying to focus. Her dress had slipped off one shoulder, and looking down he could see a loosely puckered nipple capping one sagging breast. Looking back at her face, he began to think that this might be the woman from 217, the one who had tried to strangle Danny. On his other hand, the man in the sharp blue suit had removed a small, pearl-handled .32 from his jacket pocket and was idly spinning it on the bar, like a man with Russian roulette on his mind.
I want...
He realized the words were not passing through his frozen vocal cords and tried again.
I want to see the manager.